Hi, I'm Vernon Trulliger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Dorothy L. Hitchmouth, OD. Where did you grow up?
That's a really good question. My father was career military, so I grew up all over the world, all over the United States. I was able to live in Europe. I was able to live in Japan. And when my dad retired, we all moved back home. Home was in the greater Boston area. Both of my parents are children of immigrants. So the rest of the families on both my parents' side lived there. And then I ended up staying there for a number of years and completing all of my education in the Boston area. And then I ran for the hills. I now live in rural New Hampshire and really have been in rural New Hampshire most of my adult life.
Your dad was career military. What did your mom do?
My mom was a hairdresser with a very successful business. Actually, it was her hard work that, quite frankly, pulled us out of, maybe the word poverty is a little strong, but certainly pulled us out of the lower middle class.
Was that after your dad returned to the States, or was that?
When you retire from the military, you're kind of just pushed out into the ether, especially in the enlisted ranks. The public had a hard time translating those skill sets in those days, and quite frankly, up until more recent times. And so it was a little bit hard for both of them to kind of get cranking in the private sector. But when they did, they really took off, and so I watched both of them try to figure out how to run a business and get ahead.
So what did your dad do after he left the military?
So my father ended up being in charge of all of the security at Merrimack College, which is in the greater Boston area. And it was because of that job that I was able to go to undergrad, to college, for nothing. $100 registration fee. So that job ended up being one of the most valuable insights that my father ever had, because I ended up going to pre-med at Merrimack for nothing. I guess it wasn't for nothing, since he was a pretty hard-working dude. My youngest brother ended up going there for nothing. I have two siblings in between there, who ended up going to college for almost nothing. So we feel pretty darn lucky. I have a brother who's a Division I A football star, so he's on a full scholarship, and my other sister ended up being like the fourth of, we had so many kids in school and they didn't quite make enough money, and so somebody felt bad and she got a bunch of scholarships and grants. So we feel pretty blessed in that regard.
After you completed your training as an optometrist, you were the chief of optometry at the Department of Veterans Affairs Hospital in White River Junction, Vermont, for 22 years, including concurrent consulting work for industry and universities. Why private practice now?
Well, the real story is that I'm crazy. So I was at the VA for 22 years. The VA was a labor of love for me. So from day one, I'm like, these are my peeps. I understand the language. My father was career military. That's what I grew up around. I thought it was an honor and a privilege to take care of these guys. I spent time in VA training as an intern and then as a resident. And so I thought it was a really important way to pay it forward. And I kept saying, oh, I'm only going to stay a few years. I'll leave next year. So I actually started a private practice 22 years ago at the same time. So I've had a private practice and I've been full-time at the VA for that entire tenure. About halfway through my time at the VA, I started consulting work, because one of the privileges that you're handed being a VA doctor are professor appointments in a variety of places. I started a big teaching program. That is not what I thought I would be doing. But between the VA and the interns and students and residents, I guess I developed some kind of expertise as a result of that. It's that expertise that allowed me to start my healthcare consulting business and grateful for that as well. I'm also a bit of a fighter, and so I was injected myself or became involved very early on in organized optometry. So I'm a past state president, and I've been involved with the American Optometric Association for probably 25 years now. So as a patient advocate. So I spent a lot of time testifying in front of state legislatures and on the federal front. And I guess I attained a little bit of regulatory knowledge by accident in doing the good fight, as they say. So again, that just added to my ability to have a knowledge baseline that seems to be valuable to companies who want to do business in the eye care space.
So why private practice now?
I love seeing patients. You know, I get to visit with different interesting people every day, all day. And in a rural area, there's a real need. So the one thing that I knew, even stepping outside of the VA, is that there was a real need in the community that I live in. I was commuting to the VA for some distance. But my new office that I just moved closer to home is right across the street from a critical access hospital. There are not enough eye providers, quite frankly, not enough providers of most types here. So I thought it would be great to be 2 minutes from my office and to be a different part of the community than I had been before. And I'm having a blast. I love it. I'm in a rural community that's also aging. So I have a lot of elderly patients with a lot of complex eye diseases, and that's really all I did at the VA. So I felt well prepared to help. So it's good.
So your new London location is rural, as you said, and you share space with another OD over in Hanover.
Right.
Why did you choose to share space with another doctor for your second location?
Yeah, so actually I merged my original private practice with that practice a few years ago. Okay. And it was really a simple decision. We were about a 45-second walk from each other's office in a really high-rent area. And I said, hey, Dr. Sam, why don't we just put everything under one roof here and reduce costs and merge equipment, and that took about one or two sips of bad brown liquor and the deal was done. So so I'm grateful to that, and he's been a great business affiliate in that location, and of course I still actually go there once a week. So we still have a partnership going. If this is going to be a podcast, I'll be shameless and say, we need help up here. It's really difficult to recruit young doctors to rural areas. But I'm like, hey, you guys, this is great. You know, they're safe areas. People need you. There's like no crime. You know, everything is good up here. You know, it's a little tough to get a date, I guess. But, you know, if you're not looking for that, it's a great place to practice. So we would love to have a partner, and that would be great, or two.
So how far are you from Boston, and how far are you from New York?
So we are about 4 hours from 4.5 hours from New York and a couple hours from Boston.
So not too bad.
To me, it's like, yeah, not too bad. You can still get your city fix. You know, with my consulting business, I actually travel. And when I travel, I'm in a big city invariably. All over the country, and that's good enough for me. So I tell people, you can go anywhere you want. Airplanes are like really cool technology, and it's a great place. It's great to be able to come back home and just chill.
So you do travel and lecture a lot. What's your favorite city?
Ooh, that's a tough question. You know, I've always liked Boston, but of course Boston's in my backyard. You know, that's a tough one. If you ask me the same question, where was your favorite place to live growing up, I would have a similar difficulty. You know, San Diego's pretty nice. I would say that's high on my list of places to visit. But, you know, Boston's my favorite. Maybe because it's more familiar, but it's an old city with a lot of history. There's a lot of personal history there for me. It's almost like not a city, but you have all the amenities of a city. The weather is great. You know, it's on the coast. There's just like great food. There's a heavy immigrant population there, so it's a multi-ethnic area, which I like very much. So yeah, that's probably my top.
Well, a lot of people equate their favorite city with food. So what's your guilty pleasure food?
Ooh, so mom's Italian. The list is really long. Guilty pleasure food. Chocolate. What else am I gonna say? Dark chocolate, to be really specific. Yeah, that's an easy one.
How do you educate patients that overall health affects ocular and vision health?
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm actually glad you asked that because I'm on some advisory boards for nutraceutical companies and health and wellness companies, and the conversations that I have with patients all day long, every day, are quite simple. Don't smoke, eat your fruits and veggies. Little bit of wine's okay, not too much. Drink some water, go outside. It's that simple. Nobody believes me, but I'm like, you know, these are the things that you need to do to prevent going blind, even if you're at risk for blinding eye diseases. So my family has high genetic risk for something called macular degeneration. There are millions of people at risk for this in North America, and we know what the risks are that are associated with vision loss from that stuff. So even if you get dealt a bad hand, right, you have the bad genes, you know, eating fruits and vegetables every day in a good quantity can actually slow these diseases down and prevent the devastating visual effects. No smoking. That's the other big one. I go on the radio actually and talk about smoking in the eye because I think, you know, members of the public don't really, they think, oh, you know, smoking's bad for your lungs. You know, smoking can cause lung cancer. And they know these kinds of things. But it's one of the number one offenders or implications in eye disease, specifically blinding eye disease. So that's like my number one message.
You've partnered with Zeiss Meditech in your practice, am I right?
Yeah, so I work for Zeiss Meditech. They're my primary, they're the primary business that I consult for right now. That's on purpose. I think Zeiss is a great company. They have great products. I love their philosophy. I think they're definitely, you know, patient first, doctor centric. So I love that. So when I open my new office, I'm like, okay, we're gonna, and you can see it in the background here, on the podcast, you won't, but I decided I wanted in my little rural area, I wanted the best of the best, the latest technology for my patients. So I opened what I'm terming a Zeiss Center of Excellence.
So has working for industry changed your approach to patient care then?
No, it has not, but it has provided me with the ability to make sure I'm getting the latest and greatest for my patients. I think that's for sure. You know, it's influenced, you know, the decision-making process. Should I buy this equipment? Should I wait? You know, is that cost too much money? Can I make this worth it? Or is this not adding a thing to my clinical decision-making process? You know, been there, done that with all of those. So it's definitely helped with that.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know. I'm a pretty chatty Sally. It's all out there. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty much not much they would know. You know, do I have some weird habit or some weird hobby that they might not know about? I don't think so. I think that they know who I am and what I like and, you know, optometry is my passion too, right? So I spend most of my day, most of my life, doing stuff that has something to do with eye care, vision care. And so, yeah, I don't think they would be surprised for me to say, yeah, I don't do much else.
Well, I was going to ask you, what do you do for downtime? Although it sounds like you don't have much.
I'm super busy. I like that. I think it's a privilege and an opportunity, and I have a really bad singing voice and I can't play an instrument, although I try to sing to myself regularly. Sometimes it sounds awesome. I do like to actually paint. I would say that is something that chills me out. And maybe when I stop running around so much, though I doubt that'll ever happen, I'll paint more. I love photography as well. So in my Zeiss Center of Excellence here, I actually have all kinds of photo art, I'll call it, all over my walls. I also have local artists displaying their art here. So that's something I like to support and do when I'm not working, whatever that is.
Why are you drawn to and passionate about charitable organizations, and why should other ODs be more involved?
You know, not to get too biblical here, but there's this saying, to whom much is given, much is expected. And I just try to live my life by that one simple statement. I feel like it's been a privilege that I accidentally got to live all over the world. It's been a privilege that I had a step up on education. It's been a privilege that I have the ability to do something with that education. And there are lots of people that don't have those opportunities, that don't have maybe even the will, because of a whole host of reasons, and they just need a hand up sometimes. So why wouldn't you do that? If everybody did just a little bit for their neighbor or their friends or their family, I think, you know, maybe there's an old hippie in me. I don't know. I just think that's how it should be, you know. And, you know, anytime I think, oh, God, I'm tired, I've worked too much, maybe I overdo it, I'm like, you know what? I bet your Mother Teresa never complained. I just always think, yeah, that, you know. So that's, it's all good, right? So I just think, and I'll say, too, that every time I've helped someone or become involved to help an organization or raise money or do whatever, it's paid me back in some way. Maybe not immediately, and that wasn't my expectation ever, but looking back now over 30 years or so of my adult life, I'm like, wow, you know what? I can at least look back and say, yeah, that was a good ride, or I'm so glad that I became involved in that, or I'm so glad that I met this person over here who was inspiring that I never would have met if I hadn't sort of stepped out a little bit in some ways.
How should optometry move forward?
Well, I think we have no choice but to really, because we have this aging population who's getting sicker, right? It's just the way things are going right now until we figure out a healthier way to live on Moss, which I don't see happening in the short term. And there's a lack of primary care doctors. There's a lack of healthcare providers in general. We're going to have to step it up. We're going to have to figure out a way to provide better primary care advice, secondary care advice, and take prevention and wellness seriously. You know, we interface with, I don't know, 200 million people a year in the U.S. We're everywhere. I think there's 90% of the Medicare population lives within 15 minutes of an OD. I mean, that's astounding. I hope that fact is true. I'm pretty sure it is. But if we're embedded in communities like that, where there, you know, I know there are communities where we're the only doc, or there's just us in primary care, or us and a few other specialists, we better be telling patients, okay, you know, from day one, don't smoke, right? There it is again. Eat your fruits and veggies. Make sure you see your primary care doctor. Screen patients for conditions in a more robust way that, you know, can easily be uncovered in an optometry office. Often we see things in the eye. You know, taking blood checker, taking blood pressure, checking on blood sugars, doing robust family histories. I mean, I was just down in Alabama, which is Diabetes Central, lecturing last weekend, and I'm like, yeah, we need to screen every single patient that comes into the office. It's just because early detection is important, and we know that that helps save in the long run. You know, we're busting the bank over here, as they say in healthcare. So, yeah, I mean, I see us taking a real serious role on the primary care front line.
Now, do you have any regrets after 20-something years?
Nope.
And that's a categorical nope.
That's a categorical nope.
Okay. Now we're at our last question, and we inflict this one on everyone. Feel free to use as colorful language as you wish. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
Ooh. Well, you know, they have this thing called Motorcycle Weekend in New Hampshire. It's one of these big bike rallies. It's in Laconia, New Hampshire. And I don't live in that part of the state, but I did the very first couple of years that I moved to New Hampshire. And I was only there maybe a few weeks. And then they have this big motorcycle rally. It's like literally right in front of the house that I lived in. And I'm like, oh my God, this is New Hampshire? This is pretty fun. This is pretty cool. So I'm not entirely sure that all my clothes stayed on for all of those rallies in my 20s. That's about all I can tell you on that. You know, so I always say, geez, if I run for office, how's that going to play out? I don't know. I'm just really, really glad that there were no cell phones in those days that people could use to take pictures and send them all over the internet.
Okay, Dorothy, that's all the questions I have for you. Thank you for being able to talk with me today.
Sure. Nice to chat. Take care.
Again. Bye-bye.